The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. This morning we had a conversation with Nancy Youssef, who is the Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers and has been in Libya since the beginning of the revolution there. We're talking today from Cairo, where she's taking a short break before she returns to Libya to continue her coverage. Before she was Pentagon correspondent, she was the Baghdad bureau chief for McClatchy. And here's our conversation with Nancy this morning. So when did you arrive in Libya?
I arrived in Libya right after the revolution began there, February 17th, about 5 days after that.
And where did you go? Were you in Benghazi immediately, or where did your sojourn begin?
I went straight to Benghazi, and then from there I started going to the various front lines, Ajdabiya, Brega, Raslanouf, and Benjawed, which is the furthest point the rebels got.
And well, it's been interesting to watch the news here because it's also been interesting to read some of the stuff I've read from other than the American press. But I mean, one of the things that you seem to hear constantly is about the disorganization and disunity, and the let's start with just the disorganization, disunity of the rebels. What's your sense of that?
It is disorganized. You know, what I've learned is that Gaddafi did a good job of keeping the opposition fragmented and either killing those who are a real threat or creating chaos within the opposition movement. And so I think the Libyans saw an opportunity to try to rid themselves of the regime, given what had happened in Egypt and Tunis. And it didn't quite go as quickly and as smoothly as everyone had thought. And suddenly you had this rebel council made up of people who didn't really know about governance and rebel fighters who were engineers and drivers and doctors who had found themselves becoming armed rebels. And so these protesters turned rebels didn't really organize themselves very well. And so you would be in the front line and you would see people vowing to bring down Gaddafi in the first sign of artillery by the Gaddafi regime, and they were sent scurrying the other way. And it just created a scene of confusion and chaos on the front line.
From what you can see, can you define who these rebels are, what amalgam of groups they are in Libya?
Well, you know, from what I saw, these were people who lived in the East, who lived under Gaddafi's regime. I should preface this by saying Benghazi has always been sort of the home of rebellions in Libya. It's always been sort of a modern-day beatnik town and filled with sort of thinkers and politicians. Hopefuls who sought change. And so the rebels that I met, again, weren't organized fighters per se, but really middle-class residents who wanted to take part in the overthrow of the Gaddafi regime, however futile their efforts were. But there isn't a real defining characteristic other than that they were sick of the regime, had probably been touched by it in some personally adverse way, and found themselves going from having no pride in their country to having a lot of pride in this new movement.
One of some of the things I've been reading from different press and different kind of ideologues around the world is that this really is in some ways more of a civil war than we talk about in the Western press that we've read about, in that Gaddafi has a lot of supporters in the country because of the kind of structure he's built in terms of medical clinics and schools, and they have the highest per capita income at $14,000 a year of any country in the African continent, and that it's not as easy to work our way through that because of the complexity of it and the fact that it may be closer to a civil war than we think.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's funny when you talk to some in Benghazi and ask them whether this is civil war, they're immediately outraged and they'll say, no, no, it's a war of one person, Gaddafi versus the rest of us. But I agree that it's not as clean as that. And the proof of it is, in Tripoli, we haven't seen thus far the kind of rising up that we have seen in other parts of the country. And even in Benghazi, it was easy to find people who were clearly sort of still working for the regime in some ways. They'd be filming us as we were gathering at the courthouse. Or one time I called someone by mistake and got someone in Benghazi who was a pro-Gaddafi supporter. Now, I don't think that they're a huge number, but they're enough, I think, to sort of plant the seeds and the basis, if you will, for what we would call a civil war. But it's a term that Libyans reject outright, at least in Benghazi, because they see it as one man versus the whole country. I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that, but how loyal, how fierce the support is for Gaddafi, it's unclear, but it remains even in the East. We saw it most primarily in the fighting when people would come out of their homes and start attacking the rebels.
Huh. And who were those people who did that?
You know, I never really got to know them because they had no interest in talking to the likes of us because we were a nuisance in their lives. I just I encountered them in firefights, if you will, when all of a sudden these homes were being used as areas to attack. Now, conceivably, they could have been Gaddafi folks brought in from somewhere else, but you could never get a straight answer from the people in Benghazi who we find who were filming us because they would say things like, oh, we're just here to welcome you. And it was clear that they had pro-Gaddafi leanings, if you will.
They reported today in the paper that a former Republican congressman went to is meeting with Gaddafi to urge him to not surrender, but to give up power. And that even though he's not working on behalf of the White House, he is the White House knows he's there and doesn't oppose his visit. So when you from your reporting, I mean, how likely is that? What's your sense of where it all is now between militarily in Libya?
Well, I've learned to never make predictions in Libya because it's a unpredictable place. But that said, I think it's fair to say that this has entered a stalemate. And the question becomes, what does Gaddafi gain by entering some sort of negotiation right now? As it is, his forces have been able to keep the rebels back and keep them fighting for this sort of 150-mile area between Benghazi and Sirte, his hometown. The rebels are at least a month away from having any real military prowess or posing a threat to the Gaddafi regime. So from my experience there, it doesn't seem likely that that's going to happen and that Gaddafi doesn't need to negotiate now. And on top of that, there's that unpredictable factor of his ego and his temperament that is playing into all this. And he hasn't shown a propensity to negotiate or to talk. I think we're a ways away. It felt that way when I left. But again, Libya is an unpredictable place and things can change quickly. But when I left it felt like we were entering the beginning of a long period, not the end of something, but maybe the beginning of a new period.
It's fascinating to me that when you look at Libya, you look at Tunisia, you look at what's going on in Yemen, Bahrain, Syria, even Jordan and Palestine to an extent, how different each story is. I mean, the political dynamic in each of those Arab countries is very different.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Before I went to Libya, I was in Bahrain, where the tenor and the issues at hand were so different. They were more centered around sectarianism rather than Libya's, which seemed to be more about a nationalist movement. But they're all sort of driven by the same thing, and yet the internal factors are so, so different that there's not really a connective thread between them. The only one that I've been able to sort of come up with is to divide these into groups that are fighting along sectarian lines and those fighting along nationalist lines. That's about as far as I can group them. But after that, they all come with their own story and nuance, and part of it is the people, and part of it is how the regime have reacted and what they can and can't do to sort of meet the demands of their people. So it's funny, as you travel to these countries, there's not one that sort of prepares you for the next one you're about to cover as a journalist, because they're all so different in tenor and tone and in terms of what's driving the people and what's driving the regime.
When you see politically what happened with NATO and the United States and the bombing and, of course, some special forces and other special ops on the ground, I mean, what is it when you look at Libya as opposed to the other countries that you've been to and covered that makes it so significant for the West, why they have to be in the midst of this? I mean, the people talked about Gaddafi and potential genocide, but then I've read other articles saying that really wasn't true. There was no evidence that Gaddafi was going to slay thousands and thousands of people, but may have captured hundreds and put them in prison in the process of fighting the rebellion inside the rebels in Libya. So, what is your sense of what is so unique about this that brought in the West in such force?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think this has sort of renewed the debate about whether the United States, as someone who's watching from the outside, whether the United States wants to be the ones that do the sort of morally right thing in cases like this. Now, you're right, there's no evidence of it, but I talked to people who lived in western Benghazi where the forces were coming in and they were threatening to level the city. It's the unknown, and the problem is not doing anything and learning the hard way would have been devastating as well. I'm not even objective on this because it would have been friends of mine who have met along the way who would have been killed potentially had Gaddafi forces been allowed to come in and NATO had not intervened. So there seems to me that debate going on about what role does the United States want to be? Does it want to be the one that sort of demands a certain amount of moral standards from the world community? Now, the other factor that is not as much for the United States, but certainly is for France, is oil. The United States doesn't get much of its oil from Libya, but France and other European countries do. And that's all been up in limbo since this all began. The refineries now are in Gaddafi's control still in Ras Lanuf and Brega, but the oil itself is in the east. And so that instability certainly affects them and by extension, the world markets. And so to me, those, as someone who's there for it, those were the two driving issues.
It's interesting when you said earlier that the people in Benghazi, some of the people that you've covered and worked with, that you have an empathy for. And I like to explore that a little bit. I mean, is it that some of the people who are in rebellion represent, for want of a better term, kind of the cosmopolitan, more secular parts of the population in the Arab world? And I think that because I was thinking about, you know, the Giuliano, Mayor Kamas was just assassinated, murdered in Jenin. And the Palestinians I've been talking to and some of the Israelis over the last couple of days by email, their sense is that the secular forces for a world that's not allied with the U.S. or anybody else are really under attack from a number of areas. I mean, are you getting that sense that the folks that you're talking about in Benghazi are part of those kind of secular forces?
I did get a sense. It was one of the most secular countries I had been to. But even more than that, I've never met such a kinder group of people. Of course, part of it, they welcomed us because they wanted their story told and they wanted to do anything they could to see their country liberated from Gaddafi's rule. But there was just a genuine kindness that you encountered everywhere you went in Libya. People just opened their homes so freely in a way I really haven't seen in my life. I mean, we would go to places like Ras Lanuf and show up as strangers and say, we need housing. And they would open up. We met a man who opened up his brother's abandoned home and let us use it freely without any questions. And where offering money was seen as an insult. There was a real sense of camaraderie and community there. There was just a wonderful spirit in Libya. And I felt like it was such a privilege to go and see this country that had been forbidden to so many people so often and just find a wonderful spirit there and an enormous amount of kindness. In addition, it is a secular country and you certainly got that sense and that there, you know, I've heard talk about Al-Qaeda fighters coming out of Libya and going in places in Iraq and Afghanistan. I didn't really get to encounter them as much because they weren't there. And what was remaining was a secular group, were people who really embraced what the United States would call moderate Islam.
I mean, there was a story, I think, that there was a story in The Economist that there were jihadists from the Green Mountains who are now part of this and are kind of could possibly change the nature of the revolt and revolution inside of Libya. They said jihadists are both supporting and exploiting what's happening throughout the Arab Spring, but specifically they were talking about what's going on in Libya. Somebody, they quoted this guy who's Safan Ibn Kumu, who was an inmate for 6 years in Guantanamo and drove trucks for Osama. And so so what you're saying is you've heard of that, but you haven't seen evidence of that in your travels in Libya.
I didn't. And in fact, I was in Darna, which is once you get east of Benghazi towards Cairo, I had the opportunity to stop all along the way. And I stopped at a little town called Darna. And what I saw there was a real mix of actually Islamists and secularists working together in an effort to form some sort of government to replace Gaddafi. They weren't as sort of bogged down by trying to liberate the towns west of Benghazi. They were more distant from that. And so they were really looking at governance. And it was extraordinary to see these Islamists and secularists working together. So I think so often we focus on the possible threat, but I also think Libya offers an opportunity for a new kind of governance where these formerly adversarial groups work together because they see the opportunity as so precious and they don't want to lose it over those differences, but rather find where they can agree and come up with a form of governance within that.
It was interesting. I was also reading this morning on Voice of America that that Abdel Fattah Yunus, who is, I guess, one of the head of the military, one of the leaders of the rebel the rebel forces in Libya, was saying he was upset that NATO didn't come to the certain town of Misrata fast enough to protect them, and they were forced east. But then the Minister of Defense, the French Minister, Foreign Minister Juppé, said that the situation in Misrata cannot continue, and promised to do some to pick up the heat after talks of with leaders of NATO. So what does that say to you in your sense of Libya and where this may be taking it in the next couple of weeks?
It tells me that the opposition is really divided about how much Western intervention they want in this, how much of this they want to be their own movement, and how much of it they need foreign intervention to help them do it. In my time there, it's clear that the rebels can't do it by themselves. They just aren't organized enough. They don't have the weapons to do it. They don't have the training to do it, and they don't even have the time to do the training properly. So they need some form of Western intervention, and yet. To do so would really, I think, in some people's minds, tarnish the movement as something done by the West and not by them. And so I think what you're seeing are those divisions and also the lack of political leadership, which, as I mentioned, is a function of the lack of oppositional organization that happened up until this point. You know, when you think about Iraq and what happened there, when Saddam's regime and even leading up to it, there was a really well-organized machine of opposition members, whatever you may think of them. The names Ahmed Chalabi and Ayad Alawi were known before Saddam's regime fell. Whereas in this case, there isn't a real known opposition. These are all people coming together for the first time. And so I take away from that they're divided about what's an acceptable outcome, and they're divided as a group in terms of how to go about leading this. And it's one of the many problems going forward, because if and when Gaddafi's regime falls, the question becomes who replaces them. It was startling in Benghazi when the sense you got that there wasn't a real clear leader yet to emerge and lead this country forward in what will be a critical period.
Well, we look forward to a great deal more from you. And when do you return to Libya?
And another 6 days, it looks like.
We'll be in touch before that and be in touch as much as we can during that. And I do appreciate everything that you do coming on our program, Nancy Youssef, from McClatchy. And also, in the bottom of my heart, I want to say please be safe and take care of yourself. And we look forward to seeing you back in Washington.
Thank you so much.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.